Good morning. We'd like to welcome everyone to this morning's special meeting of the Mesa City Council, Thursday, January 13th, 2011. It is special, but this is especially special.
This is
an especially special, special meeting. Should read your agenda. That's what it says. Especially special, special meeting.
My technology isn't working.
Oh, okay. The reason for this special meeting is to handle an item that involves the way City Council does business, and it's to introduce an ordinance so that we can put this into not motion, but
emotion.
So we can make it happen while we start a new year.
In action.
Put into action. Thank you very much, Vice Mayor. See, that's what's going. I'm going to miss the sort of filling in of the words. And the item is that we're introducing is a change to the city code. Just a little bit of background. Our city council has six standing committees. These committees are allowed by the charter, but are not required by the charter. So these are at the discretion of the city council, the establishment and naming of these committees. The committees have evolved over the many years and have changed, and the names have changed, and the focus has changed. And what we're proposing, or what I am proposing to the council, is that we tweak the names a little bit more. I think all of the council has been briefed previously by my chief of staff, Kathy McDonald. And since the names of the committees are embedded in ordinance, then we have to use an ordinance to change the name and the establishment and the formation of these committees. So that's the purpose for this. We wanted to make sure that we were able to get the committees moving as reformulated when the new council is set as quickly as possible. That's why we're introducing this ordinance. So nothing big. There aren't major changes, tweaks to names. And the idea was that the six city council committees would be more in alignment with the strategic initiatives that we've established as a council. Also, the city departments, many of which have been combined and restructured, and also to try and line them up as much as possible to citizens' advisory boards and committees. There's not a perfect match. Not everything that starts at a staff level or at the citizen advisory committee level comes through or comes anywhere close to a council committee, but we tried to align those just in case, and if there was a time when we did that. And it also brings it causes to think about the role of the council committees in general. So that's why we're having this this special meeting, so we can introduce the ordinance so that in January 24th we can the next council meeting we can take final action if we need to. Any questions? Councilmember Summers.
I thought this meeting might go a little too short and be devoid of anything exciting. So I thought, when looking at these committees, I don't necessarily have any problem with the committees. But as a topic for discussion and consideration by the council, I'd like to raise the question of why. I'm wondering if this council actually needs to have any standing committees. What seems to happen often is that things just get rehashed twice. Goes through a council committee of three people, staff presents a presentation, and then a few weeks to a month or two later, the same presentation is given at the study session. Exact same one, where either three council members then proceed to fall asleep because we've heard this before, or at very worst, sometimes.
Is that the reason why you fall asleep?
That's one.
Oh, okay.
That's one. That and your dulcet tone. I said dulcet. But the other one, and I'm guilty of this too, it seems that sometimes we do quite a bit of work on something at the committee level, subcommittee level, to have it come to council as a whole, where it's never been heard before, have the same questions asked, and then I feel like, why are we asking these same questions? We already hashed this out. This should be a no-brainer. The other four of you should just approve the glorious work that we have done. Oftentimes that happens. Sometimes it doesn't. And then we're rehashing and re-asking the exact same questions that we did at lower level. That doesn't mean that the committee, the subcommittees, in many instances, don't serve a purpose. But there are issues that really do need to or should be heard at the subcommittee level. I'll raise one. Mr. Richens, Dennis Kavanaugh, and Councilmember Higgins did a splendid job on the CDBG here recently. But we don't need a standing committee for that. I think we could get by with having ad hoc committees. So for those issues that are important to council members, if we don't want to hear it as a committee as a whole yet, we could certainly hold ad hoc committees for that particular issue where everybody, the three people who are interested could hash out that issue, and then when they feel it ready, bring it to the entire council for a study session. So I throw it out there, Mayor, as a question to see what folks think, if they want to even have any standing committees, or maybe we only need one or two standing committees, or none at all.
Okay. And in full disclosure, Councilmember Summers raised this issue, and we've talked about it before, and I thought it was important that we have this discussion. I knew it was coming, so this is not a surprise. So, and I think it's a valid question, and it's one that I appreciate you raising. Councilmember Finter.
One thing I really like about what is coming forth is this process, or the new way of organizing this, aligns many of the committees with the, or at least the council's participation with many of the committees, and all in a logical order. And I think that's good. So, for an example, audit, finance, enterprises, or PD with the judicial system, police, fire, and the public safety. I think it makes sense. It's a good way to look at it. The alignment's smart. I appreciate Councilmember Summers bringing up the the point about the most recent with the CDBG. CDBG, thank you. That was so much volume of information. The book was huge. Somebody needed to go through that, and I had the opportunity. It was kind of awkward because we didn't have a lot of comments, but all of us, I think, had the opportunity to check with committee members, find out what the thought process was. It was a good system. I thought that was a snapshot of how this should work. So I appreciate Mr. Summers mentioning that. So I think this is a good way to go, real positive.
Okay. Councilmember Kavanaugh.
I agree with Councilmember Finter. I think it does afford an opportunity to look at an issue in detail that we may not be able to do in the confines of a study session where we're reviewing council agenda and doing other issues that staff are bringing forward to us when we have to get off to work. And so, or we have a relatively short time before a council meeting to look at the issues. I think the other asset that we have in having committees is that each of us, in terms of serving as chair or a member of the committee, I think have the opportunity and responsibilities to raise issues on our own that we may feel are important public policy issues for the council to consider. It may not be an issue that is suggested by staff, or may not be an issue suggested by the mayor. And I think that affords a greater diversity of issues, public policy issues, that can come before us for a discussion. And I think there's some merit in that process as well. I don't think committees should meet just to meet. It's only if they're real work, because we are all very busy, and we want the committee experience to be meaningful. But I've found it to be very helpful for me. I've also found it to be very helpful to hear members of the committees when we talk in full council about their experience in dealing with particular issues. It's helped me analyze and come to decisions on issues. So I think it's a worthy process to continue. Thank you.
Councilmember Summers?
No, I don't I don't disagree with those points. I'm just wondering if the standing committee is absolutely necessary. I think that sometimes we see duplicative efforts of staff having to prepare for council meetings and subcommittee meetings. It's also just a lot of time that they spend. If there are issues that are important to council members, I still think that having ad hoc committees is a way to address particular issues. One example I brought up with the mayor is that I'm still looking at the idea of a business incubator, business accelerator, that may benefit from the Economic Development Committee, but I could ask two council members to serve in an ad hoc committee, and if we get, and let's face it, if I want an issue to come before this panel, I can call on any two council members and it comes before this body. Or I talk to Chris, or I just talk to the mayor. So three council members together can form an ad hoc committee. We'd have to figure out what those rules are. So I think it's a best of both worlds. But like I said, this is for discussion. And I put Dave to sleep.
Vice Mayor?
The experience I've had using these standing committees has been interesting in that when you hear about councils in other parts, other communities, and we talk at NLC and stuff, where they go hours on end in meetings because they didn't work out details ahead of time. And we have been very fortunate because a lot of our discussion that takes place in those committees, even though sometimes there may seem like some redundancy from the committee to the full council, if there is something that just doesn't sit right, it's an opportunity for us to let staff know that there's some concerns. They have a chance to work on it before it comes to the full council, and it truly minimizes the time spent in a meeting such as this. Although there are times when we need full discussion and we know we're not always going to agree on things, but yet it allows a chance, another level, so to speak, of if there's a red flag to be put up and say, wait, we're going down the wrong path, that can be addressed well before we get to this point. And so I still think there's real value in those standing committees.
Okay. Councilman Fender.
Just as a follow-up, too, I think there's leadership involved for the committee member, or for the committee chairs especially, and having a point person for staff to come to, and just a lot of things don't even make it to a committee level, but could be bounced off a chairman or chairperson and be able to say, hey, what are you thinking? You know, most of us have a pretty good idea where we stand on things and other council members. So I think there's a leadership that could be a component that could be lost by just kind of having it, a little more fluid. I think it might help the system to have a point person to go to on a particular issue in a particular type of area. So
where do you stand on me?
I am.
On your chest.
You know, this is a new concept, a new proposal, something that I think merits maybe some discussion. Because I don't think I heard Councilmember Summers saying he wanted to do away with committees.
No,
I think I heard him say that change the way we do it. And there are certain committees, audit and finance, for example, has ongoing responsibilities. What the current TIC, which is now going to be the Sustainability and Transportation Committee, has certain things that goes to the public safety, but there are other issues and other and the CDBG process. I think we found that actually, although it wasn't perfect this time, I think it was a gigantic step. Well, that was, I'm just quoting Councilmember Richens. Well, he said he was perfect. This the process wasn't perfect.
Our chair did a marvelous.
And I would agree, the chair did a marvelous job. Well, who screwed it up then? No. No, I think that we're going to have the singing tie now, huh?
There we go. Oh, you can't hear it. No.
That is the wimpiest singing tie I've ever not heard.
You know, it's years old. I need a new battery. It's not very loud.
I have been asking him to bring this tie in for a long time.
I think we've gotten to the point where the vice mayor said, what are you going to do, fire me? I can get away with anything. I'm gone anyway. No, I think that there are some, I think it's a good discussion to have, and maybe as if you think about it a little bit and we want to bring it up again, we can adjust this at any time. As I've said, these are, committees are a creation of the council. We're authorized under the charter to create committees. We're not required to. And we can create whatever committees in whatever way, in whatever way, shape, form we want to. We just have to do it through ordinance. So, you know, maybe as we go forward, Councilman Richens, and then we'll, Mr. Brady.
You know, I like this idea about how, you know, it seems like you've come up with a way to streamline this process a little bit and line stuff up. I'm really open to Councilmember Summers' idea. I want to try this for a while.
Yeah, so we can discuss this. I think it's a great idea to lay on the table, and let's think about it and see how it goes. And we can change it anytime we want. We can adjust. We can amend on the fly as we go. If we find a better way of doing it, I think we ought to keep an open mind to doing it. So let's. And this is new for, you know, Councilmember Summers discussed this with me, but this is new for everyone else. So I don't expect action today on anything. Councilmember Higgins, and then Mr. Brady.
Does the process that we currently have allow for an ad hoc committee with?
We can create a committee whenever we want.
Okay.
As I understand, now, Ms. Spinner, I think the charter allows us to establish such committees as we seem fit. I'm paraphrasing that.
No, that's correct, Mayor. Yeah. You can establish.
Right. We can have no committees. We can have as many committees we can create. Well, Finance in the Future, for example, was an ad hoc committee that was set up by the council. So, Mr. Brady.
Just two things, Mayor and Council. One, for the length of this conversation, this probably should have been sent to a committee first before we...
How long have you been waiting to say that? He came up with that about 5 minutes ago, and he goes, oh.
But second,
that was pretty good, though. I like that.
Let me share this with the council.
It's good.
While there may be a little murmuring you may hear, for staff, actually, in many ways, having some element of standing committees does help us to kind of, vet some things out. Because a lot of times, we'll be discussing... ideas or things that are coming to the council we know that affect policy. And as staff, we sometimes feel a little awkward in the void of, you know, kind of going into that area of policy, and we may have a variety of ideas, and we're looking for some direction from council. So in many ways, the committees at some level really do help us, and knowing where the assignments are and who the committee chairs does help us. At least on a certain
creates
level.
Creates a sounding board.
Yeah, it really does. And so that it has become a helpful tool for the staff, too. So, but I know that there could be opportunities down the road for other ad hoc or other ways.
Well, I think the thing that you know, we have six committees because basically we have six council members. And it certainly does beg the question, do you have six committees because there are six areas of real interest that are served well, or do you have six committees because there's six council members? And, you know, it's probably more of the latter than the former, but that's not necessarily bad. And I think everyone sees the real value of the committee system. It's just how we implement it is what I'm gathering, the point you're raising.
Yeah, I didn't have a chance to talk to Chris because I just was thinking about this yesterday. And I did have a chance to talk to some staff, and some of them said we like the idea of being able to put our presentation together off camera, make some mistakes, and then tweak it before it comes forward formally. That doesn't stop it from making a headline, though. Because Gary always shows up
somehow.
Gary always shows up or finds out somehow. Somebody's telling him. But then other parts of staff said, yeah, it's me doing the same thing twice. So it just kind of depends on who you're talking to and which one. The two committees that I thought do serve a purpose, the mayor mentioned one. Well, Audit and Finance always seems to do their audit reports to the subcommittee, never comes to the full council, although everybody gets to read them. The other one, although it hasn't had the heated arguments lately, was TIC. Because invariably it's going to happen again. Development happened in the county. They're going to want to hook up to, and it was almost a quasi-judicial board, and it kind of kept the heat off the entire council and let those arguments happen somewhere else. So those are the two that, you know, sitting down with the mayor yesterday, we thought of that really served a purpose. Everything else I thought maybe, you know, ad hoc would work, but if it's the... I would agree if we want to go ahead and proceed with these particular councils from now. If I may raise one more question, Mayor.
Go ahead.
Governmental affairs, what is it that they're going to do?
They are charged with dealing with the affairs of government.
Okay, that's fairly broad.
Hey, we need somebody watching over Mr. Butler.
No,
and Mr. Butler's just a couple of offices down. I throw things at him all the time. I don't think we need. My question was, if they aren't going to have anything to do, then maybe five committees will work.
Well, we do bring the
vice mayor just
the plan each year for the legislative agenda for the both on the federal and state level and get that feedback early from the
committee. Well, and also this used to be called the Intergovernmental Affairs,
yeah,
and that
tanked.
That was it was very limiting because it talked about intergovernmental affairs, and there are other things that we have that involve the operation of government, the relationship between governments that all have to that don't may or may not fit in with a specific category.
Right. Well,
It's sort of a catch-all. There could be some things that for example relate to, and I'm just pulling this out of the air, which is really dangerous. But anything related to employee relations, for example, that don't fit into any one of these, but they do deal with how we operate as a government. And I have no idea what issue that would be. I'm just throwing it out because
that's a good one.
I'm trying to find something that doesn't fit into any one of these areas. That's what we tried to expand what government affairs what this committee could handle. And now, once again, these are issues that don't come up all the time other than perhaps the legislative agenda.
It's not very frequent.
Well,
we really even bring that usually to a study session, but they could.
We may start there and then vet that through.
Yeah. Well, you had me at Mr. Butler needs close supervision.
Councilmember Richards.
As much as I love the discussion, I'm going to make a motion to approve this item.
Thank you.
Second.
All right, so keep this in, and we may revisit it later. We have a motion to approve from Councilmember Richards, a second from Councilmember Summers. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Thank you. This does have citizens present. Do we have any requests to speak, Ms. Crocker?
No request, ma'am.
Okay, we have a motion to adjourn, a second. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
We are adjourned. We're now moving into the study session for Mesa City Council for Thursday, January 13th, 2011. And our first item on our agenda is to move into executive session. I apologize for those of you here, but we have certain council members that have other obligations, and we need to take care of some things in executive session. So we're doing this first rather than last. We have a motion from Councilmember Summers, a second from the Vice Mayor. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
We are now moving into executive session. We'll be back in a while. Thank you. All right. Thank you for your patience. And if you weren't patient, thanks anyway. But we're back again into our study session, and we'll now turn it over to Mr. Sheffield, who will give us an update on the zoning code update. You'll update the update.
I will update the update. Okay. Yes, indeed, Mayor.
Go right ahead.
We're coming back to you with some housekeeping items. We're getting ready to go through the final adoption public hearing process to determine whether or not this work that we've done for the last few years is worthy of adoption. Again, I keep emphasizing these are the goals that we're trying to do is to equalize some of the regulations relative to land use impact and form. I've shown this several times. This is just more of a reinforcement. This is what I'd like to talk to you today. Typically, I'd like to talk to you about the notice and hearing schedule. We'll talk about some items relative to the single residence districts. There's some transition policy items that we presented to the P&Z board. We'd like to make sure that the council is on board with the same recommendation. We've made some revisions to our telecommunications policy. The last time that we visited telecommunications was 1997, so we're updating that. In addition to that, we're coming back to you and revisiting some issues relative to council use permits, particularly some of the more controversial ones that the council may have some questions about. The in terms of the notice and hearing schedule, on January 11th, we went live with the final draft of our update. This is based on the comments that we had from folks from our public review draft that we released in April, and our conversations that we had with council during study sessions in September, as well as some comments we had from folks who were just commenting in general. This in mid-January, we're likely to release a legal notice of hearing. This is going to be sent by first-class mail to approximately 131,000 different people who are owners of property in Mesa. This is a requirement of state law whenever we go through this kind of, in essence, rezoning because of adopting a new zoning code. Ongoing, we have issued press releases, In addition to that, we have public service announcements that are running on Mesa Channel 11, notifying folks to anticipate receiving this item in the mail. We have tentatively scheduled a hearing in front of the Planning and Zoning Board for a recommendation on February 16th. We encourage folks who have questions about the update and what's been written for the update to attend or either to comment for that and give us their written comments, and we'll forward those on to the Planning and Zoning Board. And then tentatively, we've scheduled the council meeting for possible consideration consideration on April 18th. It's taken a long time to get here, but we've actually got a plan for an end game, so to speak. Any questions about the notice and hearing schedule? Getting into
Gordon, I do have one thing. Yes. This general mailer that's going to be sent out. I know I got something from City of Flagstaff because I had a property. And I had understood that you guys had looked at that. It's pretty interesting, the mailer was sent out, and I thought they did a great job of doing that.
We're modeling much of what we're trying to do on what Flagstaff had done also.
Okay.
We have some the difficulty with notice is that because of some of the case law, if we're not careful enough with it and someone disagrees with how we've done the notice and they disagree with that, they can throw out the entire zoning code.
Well, just to back up, I didn't really finish. I own a piece of property up in Flagstaff, and they're going through a similar thing we're going through with a zoning code update. So I thought it was just really interesting that I got that notice in the mail, very similar to what we're going through. And it seemed pretty impressive, the mailer they put out, what they said in it, and how they covered that. So I'm anxious to see. And it seemed to have done the trick. I mean, I thought it was adequate, but then again, I understand the legalese that we have to go through.
We thought we were impressed by it also, and we've modeled much of what we intend to send out on what Flagstaff has done. Getting into some of the topics, some of the revisions we've proposed to the single residence districts, right off the bat, accessory living quarters. We have proposed to delete the lease or rent requirement, right now the ordinance says that accessory living quarters cannot be leased or rented. We've also proposed to delete the special use permit requirement if they for detached facilities, as long as they maintain the location of that particular accessory living quarters within the setbacks, the building setbacks for that particular zoning district. Last time we presented this to the council, there wasn't a full consensus of the council. There seemed to be some mixed opinions. So we wanted to bring this back and confirm this is the direction we should go.
Okay. I think Councilmember Fenter has some questions or comments on this.
I will try to be brief. I appreciate we've had a long meeting, and I hope that I don't offend with my comments. I've tried to think of the most politically correct way to do this, and I'm just going to call it like I see it. Mm-hmm. My biggest concern is on taking a single family. Now, keeping in mind that I do understand that currently we do have the auxiliary living quarters, the granny flats under a permit process, and we also have the, for decades, we've had where 6 or 7 or 8 people can live within a home. Not a group home, but a...
The group home for the handicapped.
No, the lodging.
Boarding house.
Thank you. We do have that. So we have some provisions in there, some flexibility. It's been there for years. Definitely have some big concerns about taking it a single family neighborhood or a single family home and for profit allowing someone to, and again, I know there's some ramifications there, but to turn a single family home, single family neighborhood into duplexes. And, you know, I always go back, when I first made this approach, it would seem that I even thought maybe I'm sacrificing some of my principles, what I believe in, but I actually am just taking the other side of a property rights view, and I'll just say, for my personal life situation, I started out in a humble little apartment, struggling and working through all these years, working up. I've hit my single family home and my single family neighborhood. There's value there. I think there's an increased value there versus a fourplex neighborhood or different. There's different housing stocks throughout the city. So it's the system that was there. It's the system I played. It's my biggest investment in my life is through my single family home. to change up the playing rules on it. Now I am taking the position of the other side, the individual's property rights. I am all for people getting the highest and best use of their property until it detracts or subtracts from my highest best use. And I have a feeling, it's my feeling, that if we go to a by right throughout the city approach with this, it could have a negative effect on property values in a single family home, single family neighborhood. I'm trying not to rant here, Mayor, but I'll just be really quick. But I think there's some options and possibilities to try and, the reality is a lot of that goes on. I try to bounce some of this off of folks and say, hey, am I full of it here? I really want you to give me single family homeowners. When they catch wind of what the idea is, they're saying, I can't believe Mesa's thinking about doing this. They ask the question, is Scott still doing it? Gilbert, any of these East Valley communities? No one is going down this road. And if our goal is to hopefully improve the community, increase values, make it a place where people want to live, I don't know if this is the direction you really want to go. But anyway, I have a lot more, but I'll cut it off. I'm going too long.
Okay, Councilman Kavanaugh. I just want to reiterate that I continue to share Councilmember Fincher's views on this issue.
Councilman Higgins.
I couldn't add any more than what Councilmember Fitter said. I could, but he said more than enough, so I agree entirely. But
could I ask a question? Because when we talk about what we're saying here, I never thought that we were talking about duplexes. I thought we were talking about people who have a personal residence, mm-hmm. who, while living in that residence, would while occupying that residence that they own, would be able to then have someone live in the granny flat.
Exactly.
Is that what you're changing to, or are we creating a situation where someone could rent out to both sides?
The existing ordinance allows for something called accessory living quarters, which is in effect is a small apartment, so to speak, like above the garage, right, or behind the house or something to that. It's not necessarily a full duplex. It's not trying to take care
of a granny flat, yeah, a artist loft, whatever,
right,
it is.
And the idea basically is, right now the ordinance says that these accessory living quarters are not allowed to be leased or rented. They're intended for family members, for guests, for cousins, for the oldest son that's going to college that may not necessarily live in the main house with the family. And what the difficulty that we find sometimes is that it's hard to control the financial arrangements that takes place between the person who's living in the accessory living quarters and the person who's living in the primary house. This is more a function of should we really be in that business, so to speak.
Well, the question is, if you're not going to allow that, then why do you allow casitas to be built? I mean, it's sort of a circular, isn't it?
Yes. Okay. The council several years ago in the 1980s felt that granny flats were an appropriate approach. Now we've had several years of experience dealing with accessory living quarters. In the mid-1990s, the council added a special use permit requirement to allow some of these things to be detached from the main home. Initially, they were only allowed to be attached to the main home. They allowed this detached option. We've had several years now of experience with the detached options. There seems to be a general acceptance. We have very, very little controversy when these cases come forward to the Board of Adjustment unless there's some sort of encroachment into a setback. So our thought is that if they comply with the requirements that we've had in place for several years, we may not necessarily need to go to the Board of Adjustment.
And normally those don't happen on small lots. Those are large houses, larger houses, because in order to be able to fit a detached casita or granny flat, whatever you want to call it, on the same thing, that's not a 6,000 square foot lot kind of activity. You can't fit it on that.
No, we.
So these normally come up in custom home subdivisions with custom homes, right?
Or even on track properties that.
Or even track that are offered. Production.
That might be on the 15,000, 12,000 square foot lots, the larger track.
Okay, the larger. I'm just trying to, not arguing a point, I'm just trying to understand what we are proposing now. Okay. Councilmember Fincher.
Well, I just want to say I am not against the auxiliary living. I've been very supportive of it. For all of us boomers that are going to hit the age and hopefully our kids will take care of us and we can live in the back, I get it, or the in this economic times, family members coming back, and whatever arrangement you work out, government shouldn't, you know, between family members, we shouldn't have any. But when you take it to a commercial enterprise where you're going to go for profit, we have a whole slew of housing stock in this community that's multi-level, duplexes, fourplexes. If that's the business you want to go into, if you want to turn that into a business, you know, my personal feeling would go there. We need responsible in-town owners of that kind of property stock. But again, taking a for-profit, and I use the word duplex, that's probably a negative term, I shouldn't. Dual use or dual family on a single family. I don't know whatever the right political term is for it, but didn't mean to be derogative in the duplex, but you know, two different families with two sets of vehicles, or you know, maybe not even a family. So you know, that's kind of some
clarification. I guess my question is, if you have a college student living there or your cousin lives there, they still have a vehicle, they still come and go. I mean, what's the difference in the use?
Well,
the only difference is that they're exchanging money, but you still have the same parking standards. You still have the same, if you're in an HOA or in a neighborhood or in the city, you still have to follow certain rules of behavior, regardless of what you are. You can't have 15 cars versus two cars. I guess where I'm a little muddled here is it. What's the difference? Because how do you define family? Do we even go so far in the ordinance where we're saying what degree of family? Can you be a third cousin and live there and still fit? I mean, that's where it almost gets ridiculous.
Well, not to belabor the family, but quite honestly, we go out of our way to avoid having to define family in the zoning code because, quite frankly, it becomes impossible to do that.
Well, when does this become a problem, I guess what I'm asking? When does it become a problem in day-to-day? From a city standpoint, when does it become a problem?
Where this generally becomes a problem is that after they get the accessory living quarters for the mother-in-law, and the mother-in-law is 65, 70 years old, gets to be 85 or 90, passes away, what do you do with the facility afterwards? And so it's not necessarily the first use or the initial use of the property. It becomes the second. How are you going to use that space?
Okay, but let's say the mother-in-law moves out and somebody else moves in. Does anyone make a big deal about it? When do they start making a big deal about it?
It does on occasion, but most of the time we don't hear about it.
No. And the reason we don't hear about it is because there's no change in the living that goes on in that space. We hear about it when people start doing things their behavior is what causes us to notice it. Now, I guess we could argue or say, are we setting the stage that encourages or allows that behavior, which is detrimental to a neighborhood? And I guess that's what I'm trying to get to, is that what is it that offends us about this? Is it, we talk about the commercial side, but I'm trying to get, and I don't disagree that used wrongly, these things have a detrimental effect on neighborhoods. I guess I'm trying to understand where the city normally gets involved when they are detrimental.
If they get overcrowded, for example,
okay.
Someone tries to stuff a full family as opposed to a couple of people into a relatively
small
space.
They have
too
many cars?
Yes.
So why don't we, if that's what causes our problem, why don't we regulate that?
That's part of what we're talking about.
And
no, we're saying we don't allow anything regardless of what we have.
In the zoning code.
Yeah, I know.
Parking becomes then difficult to manage also, because then we have to, it becomes applicable to all single residence districts. From that standpoint, so
okay. And shouldn't it?
Well, I mean, if a person has two cars, four cars, six cars, that could be only two people there. I mean, do we necessarily regulate how many parking spaces an individual single residence can have? Do we create a cap for that type of thing? I mean, I think you saw some resistance to that just when people were talking about.
Yeah, no, I'm just raising the question.
We can't create a parking requirement associated with the addition of the accessory living quarter.
We don't currently have one. We've proposed to place a requirement that there would be one additional space required with that.
Well, but actually, we do have parking requirements. Our code does not allow people to park off pavement, right? You can't park on the lawn.
You have to park on a dustproof surface.
So it's either gravel or the driveway itself. Right. And isn't that sort of self-regulating?
Grass doesn't have to.
Well, then then you get the overflow into the street, and then people object to seeing.
Don't we have regulations as to parking in the street? You can park you can park a car for, I mean, you know, what are the requirements?
Typically on a residential street.
There
you
aren't.
Can, you, right, there aren't.
Okay, all right. Just trying to find out. Go ahead.
I really like the idea of accessory living quarters. I think they've been done successfully across the country in a lot of communities, particularly Austin is one that a lot of people hold up as a place that has created additional value for older neighborhoods by allowing these kind of things. I think the place where I kind of get uncomfortable is when the what you were describing, the secondary and third uses, when somebody purchases a home that has an accessory living quarter and they use it for a rental. So they're renting out the front home to one family and they're renting out the back granny flat to another family, and you don't have that investment, that care that goes along with the situation. So I don't know how to resolve that, because Mary makes a compelling point about, you know, should we really worry about, you know, who it is in the houses if they're just people are just there living? You know, it doesn't matter if it's a granny, it doesn't matter if it's a...
But to go to your point, I thought that we had talked about how you could not have a situation where you have two rental units, because that in and of itself...
That's part of the reason for coming back is if we go that way, do you want us to incorporate some sort of the rental's only permitted if the owner is on occupying one of the units?
Yeah, that's a tough thing to regulate. You know, if I own this home and I live out of state, you know, and I rent the front half to one family,
you can't do it. I mean, that's the control. That's the control of the neighborhood. Unless you're living there and occupying that, because this is ancillary, this is accessory living. If you're not there, it's not accessory living.
You count that as two rental units?
That's two rental units.
Two rental units in our code that have to be registered?
I mean, I'm talking not legally or ordinance-wise, but just conceptually. That, to me, is a big difference. I would never support that, because I agree with you, because you have no control. I'm just raising questions on
the internet. I want to figure out how you regulate that.
Well, once again,
somebody comes in and rents.
Well,
the neighborhood self-regulates it. Alex is going to blow up over there.
No.
Because it gets back to the issue: when do you notice this? When there's problems in how it's living?
Right.
If we have a thing, it's very simple. You have a code compliance walk up and says, and checks who's living in the primary residence. And if it's not the family, then they're in violation of the zoning code.
Mayor,
primary owner.
Okay. Well, if I may, we may want to maybe there's some legal issues that we need to vet a little bit with regard to that particular spot. Maybe if we moved on to the next topic, let's do the legal issues and then maybe bring this.
And we're not going to solve this issue, but I think it's a valid issue. I just want to conceptually. I don't want to get into the legalese of it. I just want to conceptually give you some direction, because I think if we stopped right now, you'd have no direction on what we're talking about.
Right.
Because I think we're talking two separate scenarios. I'm not getting the feeling that people want a duplex, and I think that it is right to say a duplex if you have. If you have two non-owner occupied, if I'm looking around, is there anyone here who's in support of that kind of situation?
No.
Yeah, I think that's an easy. Nobody on the council that I can see is in support of having two non-owner occupied issues on the same property. So we go from there. I think where the difference is, or where I have a question I haven't decided yet, is if you have a primary residence and the mother-in-law moves out, we're saying that you can't have anyone, you can't have another college. You can have your son living there, but you can't have another one there. And I'm struggling a little bit with that.
Okay.
Because to me, if the son is violating, is brings four of his friends in to spend the night and constantly creates a problem in the neighborhood, I have a problem with that, because my property values go down. If you have a picture-perfect model citizen as a who's not the son, but is a friend who's paying you $50 a month, and you never notice he's there, I don't have a problem with that. I just don't know. I haven't gone to the point of how you actually regulate that. Now, Alex has a comment, and then Dina.
Thank you. There's going to be some sort of regulation involved. Do we catch it on the backside and try and have people go into homes and verify who lives there, or do you catch it on the front side and with a reasonable streamlined process say, you're considering having a auxiliary living for or lease or rent place, have a you know, on the administrative hearing officer or some sort of process where neighbors can have an input. There might not be a problem. May be way out thinking this, and they say, hey, everybody's okay. We know that's a responsible person there. That's going to work out great. But if there's going to be regulation, so can we make it up front and maybe not make a big deal out of it and catch it early, or do you try and go back and on your heels with very little resources catch it there?
And I'll get back. I think you raise a good point. I've got an idea on that. Dina?
Different thing. What I wanted to point out, you had mentioned big lots. There's accessory living quarters on R15 and smaller. Haven't we seen those? I've seen them on Board of Adjustment cases.
Yeah, no,
R115 is a fairly big lot.
Yeah, they're rare, but yes, we.
So it's okay. Not just, I mean, so there's a good section of the city that can have it. It's just not isolated to large.
Yeah, but it's larger. R115 is a fairly big lot to me.
And even in some, I know we've seen some smaller areas where they've had accessory living quarters.
Yeah, no, we've had cases that have come up in the R16 and R17 districts also, but they're...
They're few and far between, but they would be covered under this with the allowance, and that's what I just didn't want the mayor to be off. R16 and R17 is what he had to say also.
They happen on the bigger.
Out of 200 cases, you might get three in the R16 and R17.
I think Vice Mayor has a question, then Councilmember Summers.
Right now, we have a situation where we have a number of those properties throughout the city. Mm-hmm. Some areas there's more than others, but we do have those. They exist now, and they typically have been something that's been there for a long time. And if it's not a long time, it's happened recently, as the example you gave. You had a mother-in-law or somebody, a grandparent, and then they're no longer there. What do you do with that property? And I think when we're talking about how to address this, none of us up here want to have somebody come in from out of state, buy properties, and just start leasing them out. Mm-hmm. Having the owner occupied, and then you say, okay, that's a regulation issue. How do you find out? Well, I think a lot of the ordinances and regulations we have in place now, it's not we're going to go out door to door and check everything. It is if you have a neighbor complaint, you have a complaint come in, that just gives us a tool, a verification tool, that they, if it's not a problem, if you haven't had an issue, neighbors aren't concerned about it, it's a non-issue. But if it becomes an issue, you go in and check it. That is a point where you can say, okay, is this an owner-occupied? And if it is not, is the mail coming there? Are they living there? Is that where your driver's license registered to? That's an easy check to do. And if that's not the case, then they're in violation, they're cited, and you address the issue. Mm-hmm. But we don't need to make a huge bureaucracy and burdensome to us in a regulatory fashion. We need to just make sure that if a problem arises, we have tools that will help us to address it.
Okay, one more comment, then we'll move on. Councilmember Summers?
Mayor, I'd like to continue with this discussion to address some of the issues. There's a show on HGTV, if you get the opportunity. It's I don't remember the name of it off the top of my head, but the show is about usually a young couple who buys a house, and they have the option to rent out a floor or rent out a back room. And then so what they'll do is they'll invest in that house to dress it up to meet the codes in order to rent that property out. And what it does is it allows it really makes it about affordable housing. They take a significant cut off of their, because of that income, they're able to afford to buy a house that otherwise many of them wouldn't otherwise be able to afford. So there's an affordable housing issue there. There's a reinvestment in that housing where older homes are suddenly spruced up and brought to code because they're going to be able to rent it out, but only if they bring it to code. So I think there's some good points to this. The duplex issue we've dealt with. Realistically, if I had one of these in my backyard, I could have a friend move in, and as long as they're not paying any money to me, they get to live there. And then who's going to know if that individual's paying me a couple hundred bucks on the down low? Nobody's going to know. So I think it. There's some intriguing ideas here. I think there's a promise of investment, a promise of affordability and some housing. There are some issues that have to be addressed. What are the codes going to be if they are going to lease it out, which I'm afraid is legalese. I am concerned about the parking issue and not having too many vehicles. I don't think you should be allowed to park on the grass or in the dirt or in the street. You should have parking actually on the driveway for that individual. If we could accommodate those things,
that I would like to see what this looks like at the end of the day.
Yeah.
Reserving the option to vote any which way.
Right. And I think that I think you've heard one consensus is we want to set up a regulatory scheme where you don't allow the duplex syndrome.
Yeah.
Double rental. I think that's easy to do. And I think that both Alex and Scott bring up some interesting points that I think you could create a scenario that says, if you are going to do this, here's the rules, here's the scenario. And there could be a regulatory framework where someone could rent out their granny flat, but they understand that there's a heightened level of responsibility. You know, you can't park on the street if you're going to do that. And I know that... forgetting any other regulation that exists, let's say that this is happening in a vacuum, because that's where we really need to think about it, that we handle it up front rather than on the backside. You know, I think that has some merit to it. And maybe if we could come up with something, and I hope we're not making this more difficult. Yeah, we are, but I know we are. But still, I think this is a scenario that happens whether we want it to or not. I would much rather have it happening in a way that we create an avenue where people can do it, but do it right. And if you can approach it with some ideas on that to satisfy some of the good points I think have been brought up, and come back to us with that specific thing. Okay. I think there's some valid points, and we don't want to create the duplex situation.
Sure.
Mayor, if I might,
yeah.
just so that you know, I think there are a lot of things that we can do based on these comments, and let us go back and try to bring something back for you to look at. I just wouldn't want the council to think that there are a lot of legal options in terms of preventing someone from buying a property and renting it out because we've got some legal constraints on that. But certainly to keep away from the duplex situation, there are some things we can do.
Yeah, so I think we go as far as we can, and then when you say legal constraints, don't look at the current ordinance as being our legal constraint.
No.
Because
we're
changing the ordinance.
Right.
So if there are other things as far as superseding law.
And there are some of those.
Yeah. And if there are some things on superseding law, I get that.
Right.
But all too often, we'll say, well, we can't do that. Well, why not? Because our ordinance says that. Well, no. That's what this body does.
Right.
It changes ordinances when the ordinances don't fit the situations.
Right.
And don't fit into our policy and our strategic objectives and the public interest. So yeah, come back with some specifics.
Absolutely.
I think you understand the sort of the scenario. I think we're all on the same page as it relates to we don't want to create a scenario where I'm driving down the street and I say, oh yeah, they rent out their house. I can tell. I think everyone agrees that's bad.
Right.
How we get to the point where there's a recognition that this is going to happen if we're going to have these auxiliary living units. And somehow come back with some ideas, and we'll see how we go from there. Okay.
Great.
I just would say I don't know if we all agree that we think that's a good idea. Are you saying
no?
I
just said we all agree on the front end. We don't agree on the back end. So come back with some ideas and see if we can find some. See if we can find some common ground. Okay.
Okay. Next.
I think the rest of it will be easier.
I hope so.
Okay.
Limited scale commercial uses on arterial streets. This is still in single residence districts. This would not require rezoning, but it would require a special use permit. The idea behind this is that we have several homes that actually front onto major streets. Oftentimes, these homes are no longer suitable for single residence uses. So there's a question of what do we do with these types of things, and oftentimes the owners are in a position where it's difficult for them to rezone the property to some sort of alternative use. The thought here is to say that we could probably come up with an alternative use in limited circumstances, particularly those properties that front onto a local and arterial street and make them eligible for the special use permit, keep it to a limited scale that would be less than 1,500 square feet for retail, personal services, and restaurants, or up to 2,000 square feet for general and medical office. They would be required to park on site, but they would go through a public review process, primarily through the Board of Adjustment. And again, this provides an alternative so that generally going to the Board of Adjustment is a little bit less expensive process, a little bit quicker process to go through rather than a full-blown rezoning case. And so that the idea here is basically providing economic options for folks who find themselves in these circumstances. Is there general consensus that this is a good idea, or again, there was the last time we presented this, the idea, there was seemed to be some mixed opinions.
I think there were, and I got some feedback after the fact that the new information came in, and I don't know if that's changed some opinion. I know Alex talked to me about the Joe's Barbershop type of a deal. This is what that would allow,
yes,
is the Joe's Barbershop scenario. But Alex?
Well, in clarity, in District 2 along Southern Road, a lot of the houses that have been there, they're probably with high traffic, have been converted into professional service type deals. I've never had any problem with that. I've tried to advocate for a couple of folks that gets that done. The one area that I kind of struggle with, and I'm hoping get more information on the retail side, there's a public review process. There's some guidelines that go with that. You know, if you open a butcher shop and you're backed up to a residential house, or if you're cooking meats and different things, is that going to affect them? And it sounds like in the public process that's going to be addressed, those concerns. So I've backed off on any of my reservations, really. The Joe Barbershop makes perfect sense to me. That's a great example, long-term, that's always works. So okay. I'm backing off on mine.
Okay.
Okay. Any
other questions, comments?
All right.
Thank
you. Right now there's a requirement for a 10-foot wide vehicular access side yard in single residence districts. This is basically allows no encroachments whatsoever. This includes any kind of mechanical equipment, pool equipment, chimneys, fireplaces, anything like that. And oftentimes builders will come to the council when they're getting a larger development as part of a PAD overlay and request that they be allowed to place encroachments in that. Councils often approve those through the PAD process. However, on a standard by right condition, we don't allow it. I heard about it. There was apparently some discussion of this relative to Lehigh Crossing and possibly deleting the vehicular access requirement from all lots. And we wanted to bring that to council and see if that's truly the direction you want to do, make that the default condition, as opposed to having the builders come through and ask for it as part of a PAD.
Well, let me ask you. I mean, my experience was that almost always a PAD, you didn't have this. I mean, how often in a PAD do we have the 10-foot, no encroachment, no anything, or is it eliminated through the PAD process? And generally, aren't most of our subdivisions that are coming through now PAD?
I can't answer the number of PADs that are out there, but I was present at the discussion.
By the way, PAD, I got to find myself. Planned area development.
Right. I was present for the discussion on Lehigh Crossings and also the special requirement that we put in there. And I think the direction that was provided by Councilmember Higgins was that if it's good for the PAD at Lehigh Crossings, as far as allowing that flexibility, why not just allow it for any development that comes in? So that's why we brought
it. Well, I guess, and to carry that on, my question is, if we normally do that, since nearly every one of our subdivisions now, I don't know what the percentage, since we don't have any plats coming through right now, but nearly everyone I've ever seen, and I know valley-wide, are PADs.
Right.
Where basically you define your own setbacks and everything. So hasn't this sort of made this a moot point?
Well,
follow up with Dina's question is if we make it a moot point through the PAD process, why do we still have it in the standard subdivision process?
The reason for asking the question is that there are several provisions that are in the code that, for example, if a person wants to park an RV or if a person wants to park a boat, if a person wants to have something wide enough to get access so they can get mechanical equipment into the backyard to construct a pool, those types of things where you might need vehicular access into the rear yard, then the 10-foot area basically provides that. If we don't require it and make it mandatory, then the problem is that the option for RV parking, the option for boat parking in particular, or it also reduces the type of equipment that can get into the backyard to dig pools.
Well, but to get back to my point, we've done that through PAD when we eliminate the 10-foot free when we approve a PAD. So if it's that important and if it's that much of a policy issue, why do we then eliminate it in our PAD approvals?
The difference in PADs is typically because you're talking about a larger site and there's generally a homeowners association involved, then they can, through their CC&Rs, they prohibit the RV parking or the boat parking in the side yard. When you have a non-PAD condition, Generally, you don't have those CCNRs that prohibit that activity from taking
place. Well, then why don't we just say that if you have CCNRs and you can control it, then you can eliminate it. If you don't, then we leave it there.
Typically, we try to avoid references to CCRs within the zoning ordinance because the CCNRs are private contracts.
Okay. Now, in the zoning ordinance, if you say, I mean, the zoning ordinance, although allows a PAD and gives, the whole purpose of a PAD is to give trade, is to trade things back and forth. And at the staff level, you come up and you say, if you'll do this, 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 we'll allow you to do that, 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 which goes against the actual zoning code, the standard zoning code, and allows for that to happen. Mm-hmm. So why couldn't we do that in a regular sense? I understand that when you have a single developer and if you have production homes, that it makes it easier. So I get that. I'm just asking a rhetorical question.
Well, I guess our question is, should this be the default condition? If the council is satisfied that we should just go to normal setbacks and not require a vehicular access side yard, we can do that. It's a simple fix.
Well, let me get back to my first question, which is, if most of them are PADs, are we really going to affect that many regardless of what we do on this?
There are, especially particularly with infill sites or sites that have been existing for a long time, vacant properties.
But they have a way to get around that right now.
Well, they don't have the PAD option because generally those sites are not large enough to qualify for a PAD. You need a minimum of 5 acres.
If they go to, can they get a variance through a board of adjustment hearing, or are those standards so high as far as setbacks that it's no, very, almost
the
impossible?
The criteria for a variance wouldn't allow that.
Okay. Yeah, because that's what I'm figuring, because it doesn't apply to any of the things. All right.
Right.
To me, this, I don't know that this is that big of an issue, and we've probably already spent too much time on it. Unless you tell me that there's a lot of developers or things that have come in and said, this is a huge issue in my development. I understand in a PAD situation, but in other situations, is it really even that big of an issue that comes up?
Typically, most people who build on properties that don't have PADs work around it.
Okay. That's good enough for me.
Okay, is that...
Leave it the way it is? Is that the direction?
I don't sense there's a whole lot of energy for this, and they wish we would have stopped the... I would have stopped the discussion about 3 minutes ago. So and I don't blame them on that one.
Okay, so leave the requirement...
Just leave it as it is. Okay. And if it becomes a problem, we can always deal with it later.
Okay, thank you. Transition policy. As we transition from the... Assuming the new code gets adopted... as we transition from the old code to the new code, we have a transition policy that's in there. The first part of this is that if you're under violation of the old code, you would continue to be a violation under the new code, depending upon, unless the code itself changes. But if you're, you know, assuming that those violations basically transfer over. If you're partially constructed, you're still under the old code unless the permit expires sometime 3 years after the effective date. If you then try to renew that and it's been and 3 years have passed, then you have to comply with the new code. If you have a planned community district, a bonus intensity zone, a planned area development, or a development master plan overlay district, there are no changes to your approved plans. The new code would not necessarily apply because you came through, showed council what your plan was as part of that overlay district. Council approved that plans. And so there are already deviations even to the old code in that particular circumstance. So we would continue forward with those same deviations. Applications that are filed after the effective date would apply with the new code. That seems relatively...
Let me ask you something. If, let's say somebody is mid-course and the new code offers some options that the old code didn't, could someone come in without initiating a brand new zoning case? Could someone come in and either... and maybe ask to come under the new code?
Yes.
And how would that, what process would that be? That's not a variance, not a board of adjustment, because you have a new code in place.
Right. It would involve an administrative review that could be approved by the planning director depending upon the degree of change.
All right. Okay.
If applications are filed after adoption but before effective date, we anticipate that there will be kind of a transition period and then. Folks may elect to use the old or new codes on their application. If they choose the old code, then they have 3 years basically to effectuate their plans. After that time, then they would have to basically modify their plans to comply with the new code. Approved plans that have expiration dates, these involve preliminary plats and special use permits, they would have to file and get their permits before the expiration of that permit. Typically 1 year is the expiration date for special use permits and preliminary plats, unless they go through an extension of that. And then if they have an existing approved plans, these are for cases that there may be vacant property now, but they have plans that were approved, say, as little as a year or 2 years ago. So they're under the old code. They have 3 years by which to build under the old code. After 3 years, they would have to modify their plans to comply with the new code. Plans with time limits, again, special use permits, preliminary plats, things that are shorter than that three-year period of time, they have to comply with that time limit still. And then plans with time limits that require design review, they have 1 year to, in order basically to file for DR. And then whenever that time limit is, once they have the DR approval, they'll have that same time limit after DR gets approved. We've shown these to the P&Z board. P&Z board has generally agreed with these. These are very similar to transition policies that the town of Gilbert adopted when they went through their code update about 5 or 6 years ago, and were generally met with some satisfaction with both the development community and the residential community that was there. We basically proposed to do something similar here. Are we pretty much okay with these? 3 years seems to be the reasonable period of time that most people accept. It's a time period that's even suggested by Prop 207.
Yeah, it would seem like if we're accomplishing our purpose, which is to create a code that's better and actually provides more flexibility in many situations, it would seem like people would want to transition quicker rather than older. So seems okay to me. Okay. And I guess if it becomes a problem, once again, we can deal with it at that time.
Sure.
Am I off on that?
No. I think you're right.
I'm not thinking of a scenario where it would actually damage somebody to force them to, that they would want to stay under the old code.
It's not always the case, but in most circumstances, we feel that the new code will actually expand people's development options.
So. And if they want to stay, if they've already started a project, they want to stay under the old code, they stay under the old code.
Right.
Okay.
Okay, telecommunications, this can be a kind of somewhat complex issue. I'll try to go through this as quick as I can. The last time council really reviewed this in earnest was 1997. There have been significant changes since then, both to the technology of telecommunications as well as the case law that's been done since then. What we're trying to do with this new policy is to set a preference order of location to design. The idea is that you kind of go through this checklist of what is, based on the context of the site, which one actually applies and which circumstance would be best in terms of doing that. In addition to that, we're right now almost every application requires a special use permit, which requires a hearing either through the zoning administrator hearing officer or through the Board of Adjustment. We're proposing to do some by-right options in industrial zones. We feel those are the least controversial locations that we have for that. And if we do that, generally the industry tries to go to the path of least resistance. And so from that standpoint, we think we might encourage more of these to go to the industrial sites than me possibly being built in a nearby residential area.
If you do that, what kind of site plan review would there be? Because even if it's a by-right to have it on that site, it seems to me like the main issue with these, and these are basically cell towers.
Right.
Cell tower is not so much that it's going to be on the property, it comes down to where it is on the property, because those people that are affected, if we're on the other side of the property, they probably wouldn't care.
Right.
But they care a lot if it's next to their property. So the by right I agree with, but it still doesn't seem to address the issue of, okay, but do you put it on this corner or that corner? So how do you determine that?
It's basically a staff review.
Okay.
Quite honestly, there wouldn't be any notification under this particular plan.
Any notification?
To neighboring property owners. No, it'd be just strictly a staff review. Now, we can try to do that. We can try to set up a different process.
Yeah, I think you're asking for trouble if you do that.
Okay.
Alex, Mr. Fenter has a
thank comment. You. And with regard to schools, Mayor and I have gotten some heat about locating on a school property. How would this be impacted, or would it just give them other options so that?
It would basically be the same process that we have now. The schools basically get income from that. The city regulates that because it's not necessarily a school function. It goes through a public hearing process. We notify property owners within 600 feet of the site when we do this, and we have a public hearing. We try our best to keep it away from that. We do have guidelines that try to keep the tower at least twice the height of the tower away from the nearest residential property.
I think that, and not getting into the federal law and all that, I think sometimes we may get it backwards, because I know that federal law allows these uses and sort of shifts the burden away from where I think they should be. And it's not so much the right to have it on a school or on someplace. Once again, it's the location. And I think that having, since we're not involved in that process because it's right. a staff issue and then goes to the Board of Adjustments, and if they don't like it, then the council is not the appeals board on that. So we virtually never get involved in these things.
Right.
But we hear from citizens, believe me, who can't understand for the life of them why the city council has no input on whether a cell tower goes on a school right next to their backyard. Somehow, though, we need to say, all right, you have a right to put it there, but that doesn't mean you have a right to put it right next to somebody's backyard.
Right.
Or it shouldn't be that way. And it seems to me like there should be some burden put on both the property owner and the industry to mitigate or reduce the interference with surrounding uses, especially if they're residential, as much as possible. I mean, I get it that they can put a cell tower on that piece of property. What I don't get is that somebody, some neighbor, some residential who backs up to industrial area is forced to have that cell tower on the backside right next to their backyard because the industrial user didn't want to put it on the front of the property. And somehow I think we need to balance that. We need to shift the burden on location, which to me is a different issue than the right to put it on the property. But I think we've gone too far to say, okay, the right to put it on the property also almost extends to the right to put it anywhere on the property that you want to put it. Mm-hmm. And then it's up to the residential neighbor to come in and fight the fight that says, no, I don't want it right next to my backyard. It seems that that's how the system works right now.
There's a process that I've talked to the city of Phoenix about a little bit. It's still an administrative review. It requires, prior to staff adoption of whatever the site plan is, that the applicant go out and have a neighborhood meeting. And if there is no opposition to that, then generally staff approves that. If there's some opposition to that, then the neighbor would file basically a letter to the staff, and they would hold a hearing from that standpoint. So it becomes kind of an appeal process type of thing. And that's something that
once again, it seems like the process, from what I've heard, and not having been personally involved in any ways, I'm getting this from, but I'm getting the same story from a bunch of people, is that we allow the right to place it on property to override and to dominate the where you put it on the property. And to me, those are, of course they're interconnected, but they're very different discussions. And a lot of our neighbors feel like they've been really overwhelmed because the deal is, listen, federal law, you can't stop this from going in. Okay, we get that. Now let's go to the really important ones. If it's going to be on the property, how do we work? And to me, at that time, the burden comes from the person that has that right by law to mitigate and to put it as far away from or with least amount of interruption as possible, which means that they may have to make some changes. They may take the aesthetic hit. They may have to accommodate because they have the right to put it on there. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't seem like the process really works that way right now. Councilmember Kavanaugh.
Thank you. I was part of the 1997 deliberation on this as well, and my National League of Cities Committee has dealt with this issue since that time. And I think what you've done is really taken a balanced approach by acknowledging what federal law requires us to do and to not put up impermissible burdens or delay the process very long. And I think what you've done in creating the location preferences and design preferences is provide a clear pathway to a lot of these applicants to exercise the right they have to locate. And I think that, again, if the light comes on and the applicant's had, if they follow the location and design preferences that you've done, it's going to minimize the concern on behalf of the public and the delay in the process. So I think that what you've proposed is really quite reasonable and I think creates a positive setting for things that can be contentious.
I think the one thing that Don and I were just talking about, Mayor, based on your comments, perhaps what we can go back and look at are some mandatory setbacks when you've got industrial adjacent to other non-industrial uses. Maybe we can just tweak that little bit of it to get more to your concern.
Yeah, and once again, I think it's a great approach also. I don't want you to think that I think we're heading it the wrong way. I just I would. To me, there are separate issues, and we can spend time to not only direct people to places like industrial, but say, listen, it's going to be a lot easier hoe if you get it row to hoe, if you get it away from and represent these setbacks and give them the incentive to not try and stick it and use that as a hammer. I think that this is one of those catch-22s. Everybody complains if they have dead spots in cell service, but nobody wants a cell tower near their house. So the reality is that you're going to have cell towers. No, they're not the prettiest thing in the world. And there's huge areas of our city that don't have industrial areas. And you can't get good cell service without putting it at a school, at a church, at a commercial site. And that's gonna be near a residential. That's just the way it is. And if you don't like that, then let's all put our cell phones down, and no one's going to do that. So I think, though, that if we're sensitive, and it's more of a process issue than it is a zoning issue. I like the idea of offering the incentive, the almost a safe harbor. But when we get to specific site selection, if we can also, in our process, be more sensitive and figure out a ways that we can have the applicant understand that, yeah, this is a big deal. By right, you're going to be there. We'll support that all the way because we think we need to do that to have order and to give good service. But let's take a little more into account, and I think we'll be there.
One last thing is I don't want to put creative design in a box. I really want to reward creative design. And, we had some examples, the fake tree. And, I mean, everybody obviously knows there are fake trees and fake swirls.
Wait.
And
it does. Fake trees? Where? I haven't seen any. I see some awfully tall palm trees, but I've never seen a fake one.
There are other ways to address that. I thought the first one that I saw was a clock tower out, I think, in Northeast Mesa. There's a little clock tower. But, I mean, I wouldn't be opposed to, people exploring artistic and creative design for it. And if we can find a way to encourage that kind of thing outside of the fake saguaros.
There are some absolutely incredible sort of public art examples of what folks across the country have done, and we actually have a pretty good exhibit of that Laura Heineman put together for us, really did some research on, and there's really some cool designs out there that don't look like
I've seen that done for utility poles as well. There's one design competition that people had designed utility poles to look like giant iron girdered people walking across the landscape holding the wires up. And I mean, there's no end to the creative uses, but we want to, I mean, I think as a community that values the arts, we want to make sure that in our design guidelines, we have something like that fosters, hey, if you're going to do a really innovative design to be really creative, we're going to support you and we're going to help facilitate you in a positive way.
The greatest one of those is if you've been to Disney World, are the major high voltage towers that are shaped with mouse ears. You've never seen those? It's really cool. No mouse ears, though. Hey, I have one question as it relates to co-locating with existing cell towers. Mm-hmm. I've heard a lot of issues about that. People saying, why don't we cluster or co-locate? What are the, educate me and maybe some others a little bit as to how that works.
Typically, we try to encourage co-location. Sometimes it's difficult to do with some of the cell facilities, particularly the palm trees, because we tried this once, and quite frankly, it's not natural to have a second set of branches on a palm tree. It looks a little odd.
Wait, you're talking about a fake palm tree.
I understood. But
it's not natural on the fake palm tree. I got you. Okay.
But just in general. We kind of close our eyes when we go past the corner of Broadway and Power. And
just in general, I mean, the technology or whatever, can you hook multiple?
Yes, you can place multiple carriers on a single tower. Generally,
I understand that they probably don't like that because they don't like.
Actually, they try to find.
They try to find those.
To do that as much as they can. Part of the problem is that when we've done the stealth facilities, particularly the palm trees, is that it makes it difficult to do that aesthetically. We're finding some new designs for that. There's the part where the dead palms get cut off, sometimes called the pineapple portion of the palm tree. There are folks that are actually locating their antennas within a fake pineapple below that. So we're beginning to see more co-location on palm trees than we've seen previously. But the fake deciduous trees, the ones that have several branches to try to look like an oak tree or something, those we've seen co-location on. a standard monopole, we have examples where we have four carriers on the same monopole.
Okay.
So it happens frequently.
Now,
carriers try to actually do that because it's cheaper for them.
Right. Now, if someone comes in, though, because I've seen some situations where you actually have two separate cell sites, is that because they chose to do that, or is that what causes that?
Oftentimes, it's the owner of the property makes it difficult to sit here and release a second portion, or they try to force a second pole
so
on the same property.
So they get more rent, or yeah. Whatever it is, whatever the reason is?
Yeah.
Now, is there a way under federal guidelines or anything where we can almost force single site if it one exists?
One of the proposals in this draft of the telecommunications is there would be a separation of 1,000 feet between poles.
Okay.
And so that would generally, if they're looking to locate in the same area, it would generally try to force co-location where possible.
All right.
These are just listing what our location preferences are. Basically, we try to use existing facilities first before we get into new ones. Then we try to go with stealth facilities before we get into standard monopoles. Same type of thing with the design preferences. We try to use existing elements that are already, the existing verticality is the industry term. And then work our way down to freestanding stealth facilities and freestanding monopoles. And again, examples of, these are probably good examples of what a fake palm tree could look like. It's hard to see the antennas because of the number of palm fronds that are in there, a fake saguaro or even a fake deciduous tree. And then exist. Then again, showing how we can try to co-locate on things like silos or church steeples. You know, I
yeah. The reception is very grainy.
Move to adjourn.
Commercial recreation or council use permits. Try to end up on a nice topic here. We're continuing to recommend a bar so that they have a council use permit in what's now called the C2 district. Then under the new code, it'll be called the LC or limited commercial district. It would be continue to be by right in GC, which is the current C3 or general commercial. Small scale commercial recreation, which was basically the indoor recreation uses. Bowling alleys and billiards and pool halls would be allowed to be by right if they're less than 50,000 square feet. If they're greater than 50,000 square feet, they would require a special use permit. If the pool hall has a restaurant license, we're proposing that it would become a by right condition in what's now the C2 district. If it has a bar license, then it would become a council use permit, similar to what the current requirement is. The part of the issue with this is the beer wine license. If they use a beer wine license, they're not subject to the 40% food requirement that they're required to have for a restaurant license. And so they wouldn't have hard liquor either. And so we're wondering if that should also be a by right option for pool halls in the C2 district. This would allow a family oriented pool hall, but they would also be able to serve beer without necessarily meeting the 40% food requirement. Is that a good idea in C2, or?
Wasn't C2 most of our commercial now?
So, but like I said, a pool hall right now requires a council use permit
right.
In C2.
Yeah, I think we need to acknowledge that the shooting pool lifestyle and business has changed dramatically from what it might have been in the past, that it's more, you know, with other recreation, I don't think it's a big deal anymore.
Yeah,
so
I
think this is probably a bad direction.
So bar license.
I don't even know that we need to have the council use permit. Do we need to really even have the council use permit with in a limited commercial? Music Man just starts running through my head every time.
I was going to say we need to go back 30 years and or more.
No, I don't know if this is Paul Newman and Jackie Gleason,
yeah.
The Hustler.
Paul Newman and Jackie Gleason?
In The Hustler?
In The Hustler. Okay, I gotcha. I'm still thinking The Music Man.
Becky, I think right Paul here in River City, you know. Yeah. Do we really need a council use permit for a pool hall with a bar in a limited commercial district? I don't think we need that council use permit option there.
Just drop the council use permit requirement in C2 for pool halls?
Yeah.
Okay. Schools and commercial and industrial districts. Right now, they would be required in any commercial, any industrial. They would not be permitted at all in the new heavy industrial district, which is we don't have any right now, but that's the new district we're creating for the really, really large industrial activities. And then it's a CUP in any of the downtown districts right now. Would you propose to make any changes, or we're proposing just to carry the same requirement forward?
Now, how do you define schools?
K through 12.
K-12, okay.
So, okay. Pawn shops. Again, now, right now, it's a CUP in the C1, C2, C3, which is proposed to be called the Neighborhood Commercial, Limited Commercial, and General Commercial Districts. They're also allowed with council use permit in industrial districts. Based on the direction we had last time we talked to you about this, you gave us the direction to prohibit them in industrial districts, and so that's what we've written in the code. Is that just kind of confirming that before we go out for final draft?
I don't.
Okay, otherwise the same standards apply. Good neighbor policy, operational standards, 1,200 feet from another palm shop and from a school. Okay, same with the tattoo and body piercing. It's a CUP in the C2 and the C3, again, limited commercial, general commercial. And in the M1 and the M2, the light industrial and the general industrial. It would be prohibited into C1, the neighborhood commercial, in the OC, which is now the OS district, the PEP, and the new HI district. Same separation requirements, same good neighbor policy, same operational standards.
This, when you say the same, as proposed or as?
As you have now. We're continuing that forward.
My own thing, and once again, this may not be the time, it certainly is the place, but may not be the time. I really think we can avoid a lot of the issues we have with things such as tattoo if we come up with some operational standards, such as we did with massage parlors, that are sort of an entry, a minimum standard, that before they even come to us, and I think we could have avoided a lot of the issues we've had recently, if we had certain basic standards that you have to meet before you can even come before the council. I mean, if we have somebody who's operating one of these things who has a history, a record, or whatever, why are we going through the council use process when we have ways that we can weed those out and we can make sure that you have good operators with good businesses and good practices? It seems to have had a positive impact on the massage parlors. Mm-hmm. And I think setting standards is not bad when we have these kind of deals, and I would like to see the staff develop some sort of base minimum standards that, in order to get to the council level, they've got to comply with. I don't think that gets legitimate good business operators away from it, because they're going to do that as part of their normal business practice. But I think it keeps the type of people that we don't want operating these businesses from even thinking of operating them. I don't think we've gone far enough to concentrate on the operational aspects and the good neighbor, making them part of an objective standard before they even get to the council.
Okay.
I don't know if there's any.
Yeah. This is another business that the public perception of it has dramatically changed over the last 5 years about the acceptance of tattooing. And I mean, when the neighborhood mom shows up, she's got tattoos. I mean, my sister has tattoos. I never would have thought that she would get tattoos. And it's just not as big a deal as it used to be. It used to be really related to biker and gang activity and that kind of stuff, but it's become mainstream. I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing, but I agree. If we set high standards, do we really need to go through a council use permit process on all of these, if we can give them meet standards? So it's worth looking at. Also, just a note on your slide, we don't need to separate tattoo and body piercings from pawn shops.
Oh, sorry.
I'm assuming that's just a carryover from the last slide.
I agree with Councilman Ridge. I think we have a good standard. I think there's a lot of things to be learned from how we handle the massage parlors. And we focused on operations. We focused on how people conduct their business rather than what they're conducting. Because standards do change. Acceptance does change. And I think you're right. I think the notion that a pool hall, I mean, we all looked around and go, why are we that concerned about pool halls? I think there are many businesses that change. And not that we're getting lax in our standards, but social mores change. But what doesn't change is that we don't want a bad operator in these things regardless. You know, we don't want someone who, because in any of these activities, we know that even if the social more changes, there's still an element that can lead to an operation that is not positive for the community. So why not just set the standards and then we have no problem? I would agree with that kind of adoption. I don't know that we're there yet because we haven't come up with that objective standard, but it would seem like over time I'd like to be moving in that direction where we can we can make it more of an objective process and then not worry about it.
So keep it as we've got it right now, but on the back side of this, we continue to work on operational standards with a possible idea of maybe eliminating
the
CUP.
I'm seeing nods across the council. That's where we'd like to head.
Okay.
Let's set some standards, move away from the council use permit, but toward higher standards that would enable good businesses to thrive and discourage bad operators from coming in the community. Is that an accurate way of, okay?
Okay. Auto-related uses to downtown. This involves particularly in the downtown core district. Council use permits required for any kind of auto sales, rental, repair, wash, or gas. Drive-through windows, both in downtown core and downtown business one. We do anticipate that most of the downtown codes will be replaced by the form-based code, the project that we're currently working on as part of the Central Main Street plan. So we anticipate total replacement of the downtown codes with the form-based code. But part of the reason for doing this is that if you're trying to create a pedestrian atmosphere, auto release, it's difficult to have an auto use and a pedestrian use occupy the same space. And so that's the reason for the council use permit.
I'm assuming that these use permits that are in place go run with the land?
Yes, they do.
Because you have several auto dealers, especially on Main Street in the eastern part, that have gone through several different owners, or not owners, but users with varying uses. And
Yeah, exactly. Okay. The Chevy dealership down the street.
Councilman Richards?
This one's tough, particularly the auto repair, because sometimes coupling, I know that my mechanic is near the Sycamore Light Rail station, and I will drop my car off there, walk the light rail, and get to work. And so there's a convenience factor that goes along with those kind of, you know, things that it leverages some opportunity there as well. So I'm kind of mixed on this one, not sure if, you know, and I also, it drives me crazy when there's downtowns that have no gas stations that you can access anywhere, and that's kind of frustrating.
Well, I guess the question is does this rise to the level that the council should be making a decision whether there's going to be a...
Let the market shake it out.
Well,
the other
let an overall is, plan...
The other option would be to downgrade this to a special use permit, let the Board of Adjustment do it, and we can still attract, basically do a context-based review and apply conditions during that public review process for the special use.
I mean, to me, once again, and whether moving toward the form-based code, if we establish a general policy and vision for downtown, we should get out of the way, and the vision should come into play, and we shouldn't be deciding whether we're going to allow a drive-through on this corner. The vision should say whether that's appropriate or not, and it should just sort of fit in and flow. And I know that's way up here as far as it, but I think we need to get more into the policy and the vision and less into the can you have a gas station on the northeast corner of a street where on the southeast corner you don't have to have a council use permit, and it's basically in the same area. It just happens to not be in the downtown. It has to be on the other side of the line. Mm-hmm. That seems a little ridiculous to me. If we're gonna outline what we want to accomplish at the staff level and the planning level and the development level, it just seemed like that should just sort of play out. Maybe yeah, I'm speaking way too esoterically here.
Well, when you're looking at the code and you're looking at the development, the amount of lot that you can develop, the lot coverage ratios, your set front and side setback ratios, that just the form of that dramatically changes, you know, whether or not somebody does drive-through windows and how they, you know, do the different kinds of businesses. I mean, that's what you focus on, the form, instead of necessarily worry about the use. But I think that will help facilitate some of that stuff out of there anyway.
Yeah, I would like to see the form-based code take over that and be almost, hopefully if it's done right, it's self-regulating.
Sure.
And for us to get out of that council use permit.
So should, well... If, with the form-based code being maybe, I don't know, 5-6 months behind where we're at with the... Do you want just leave this alone for
Leave it
now?
Alone and let's see how that plays out, and we can change it at that time. But I would hope. I got nods up and down, so I think that that's the direction.
The residence use in commercial districts, right now it's a CUP in the C2 district. We're proposing to expand that so that it would be allowed in any of the C districts, neighborhood commercial, limited commercial, general commercial. It would be by right in any of these districts with limits. The density range would be limited to 15 to 25 dwelling units per acre. They would have to reserve at least 40% of the gross area for commercial uses, so they're not taking over the entire site for residential. You're creating what we would call a mixed-use project. They would be limited to 15 dwelling units an acre in the neighborhood commercial and the general commercial districts. So there would be a cap there, particularly so you can create that transition for the smaller-scale commercial sites. The development standards are per the designator, which that's a relatively new concept that we've introduced. We'd have, if they have an auto designator, the A designator, they would use the standard suburban districts that we have, or suburban standards that we have now. If there are areas that have been designated for urban standards, they would have more of a pedestrian type of orientation. And so we have this by right option, but for one reason, they don't meet that particular set of standards that we have. They always have the option to come to the council and ask for the residential, a higher density or lower density residential use in a commercial district.
Councilman Richens?
Could you walk me through what that might, how that might work as an evolution? So let's take a suburban-oriented, auto-designated shopping center, largely vacant, maybe fenced off, maybe has non-conforming signs, maybe has some.
Do we have any of those in the
lighted issues? I don't know. I don't get out.
We're just sort of making up a hypothetical.
Just making up some kind of hypothetical, and so. If something like that, which is largely commercial now, was going to transition, and all of a sudden we add this whole new body of rights to that commercial property, that they can now do, you know, if that's a 8-acre development or a 17-acre development, I mean, all of a sudden you can have 400 or 500 dwelling units there.
Mm-hmm.
How would a case? What would a case look like working through the process?
If it was a Well, in that particular circumstance, it would probably go to the Planning and Zoning Board for a site plan review. So there would be a review there. The P&Z Board does have ability to approve site plan modifications without having necessarily to rise to the council. As a by right condition, if they are able to fit within the parameters that are specified in the ordinance, site plan review would be the only, in addition to design review, would be the only requirements that they would have. It wouldn't necessarily rise to the level of the city council. There would be probably infrastructure impacts, and they would have to address that. We would deal with that through our engineering staff.
So that kind of thing, it wouldn't even come to the council at that point to add that many.
If they were able to stay within the 15 to 25 dwelling units per acre and maintain the 40% overall commercial floor area, yes, that would be a by right condition.
Now, if they wanted to, if they went out of that and wanted to make a true mixed use, then that's a zoning case.
Yes, it would either
have to come back to us.
Yeah, it would be rezoned to MX or rezone or a council use permit plus their existing C2 zone.
I'm not sure if I'm completely.
I love the concept. I
do love the concept, but I don't like the lack of public input in that transition.
Well, as a site plan modification, there would be P&Z. Public review.
Not enough people pay attention to P&Z. People pay attention to this body for these kind of significant changes, and there at least needs to be a hearing. You know, I don't know. I like the concept too. I just don't know if I feel comfortable allowing that to just transition with simply a P&Z hearing.
Let me ask you this. Can we, for existing uses, can we have a dual type of thing that says if it's an existing C2 and they're going to change? I'm trying to ask the question in a way, because let's say it is that hypothetical that Councilman Richens has, where you already have buildings, you've already gone through a zoning, you've had a use. Is there a way we could say that those things would have to come to council? I guess it would be any situation would have to come to council.
Yeah, and we would drop the by right in that circumstance, and we would create the council use permit for that circumstance.
How do we encourage that kind of transition, but still maintain a little bit of oversight? Because to me, I'm thinking about the public. If I lived, there's usually residential districts right adjacent and around these.
Sure.
Commercial, and although those commercial centers are failing and they need some kind of reinvestment and they need a body of rights and able to make that work financially, I think about those neighbors that are adjacent to those, and all of a sudden they have, you know, 300 apartments next to them. You know, they're going to flip. And well, if I turn and tell them that I can't do anything about it.
Well, how about if it's still a by right, but the site plan has to come? Can we do that, or does that violate the overall thing? And in these situations, can we have site plans come to the council?
We'd have to develop a new mechanism in order to do that, but, yeah, we could probably develop that kind
What's
of
the
process.
New mechanism? Isn't it like a normal zoning case, except for just a site plan?
Well, I guess you would have to set up a situation. Well, it would have to be a site plan modification. We would just take away the ability of the P&Z board to be the approving body in that circumstance, and then require the council to be the approving body in that circumstance.
Well, they would function like they normally do in a zoning case. We'd treat it almost like a zoning case, except for it's a zoning by right. Mm-hmm. And what that does is it eliminates the barrier of having to convince both P&Z and the council that they have the right to do it. But it comes down to what type of development. I mean, in Dave's scenario, they could still build those 300 apartments, but we would have a lot of input and a lot more public input as to how they built those 300.
How they're situated.
Because to me, that's, yeah. But we would say, hey, listen, here's the change, because we have all these commercial spaces that are vacant. They won't come back as retail. We want mixed use. We're going to remove a burden. But we still want to have some say into how that actually plays out. And I don't know I'm just throwing out a concept here, which would seem...
We can work on the specifics, but I think I get the general idea.
Yeah,
we,
I don't
so
feel
So we would go through the same process, but it's a site plan process as opposed to a rezoning.
I love the thing. I just don't feel comfortable with not having input. You know, we just talked about cell towers. I know Alex has gone through this. It's so frustrating to tell people that we have no input and we have no impact on a land use, and that's the expectation.
Sure.
And this is a fairly significant change in land use that we're talking about. One that we are encouraging, that we want to, by policy, to encourage. I think that we feel just a little bit like we'd still like to have our hand in it until we see how it plays out.
Well, we can keep training wheels on it until we get comfortable with it, and then we take the training wheels
off.
We got both the director and the legal department coming up.
We think that we need to go back and review this and come back with a proposal on it. There's some legal questions here, so we have to
I knew there would. Now, with that, though, I like the idea that we're opening up and creating by right uses. Because I think the only way we're going to get these mixed-use developments is if we lower the barrier to allow developers to come in and invest the time and the money. Because what's going to happen is that we don't get development because you've got to spend a lot of money on upfront costs to do renderings and site plans, and people aren't willing to do that if they think they've got to go through a nasty zoning case. So I like, and I think we like the idea of encouraging that type of flexibility, that kind of reuse, but we still want to have some control on the site plan at the council level.
And I think what we need to do is talk more about process.
Yeah.
And look at that streamlining portion of it up front for this particular type of a situation, and come back with some specific proposals.
And I know there are people who would argue that, well, what you're doing, Mayor, is you're still creating the same kind of thing, but I think it's different if they have by right, and you know, they come in and say, well, I know I can do this development. We're just going to talk about how I do the development. That's a whole different issue for a developer than not knowing whether they can even do it or not.
Well, yeah, and what happens if they can't get 4 votes on their site plan? Do they lose the ability to do it?
That's the question. That's the procedural question. We got to talk through.
Yeah. Okay, and going back to some of the standards questions, though, is the 15 to 25 dwelling unit per acre density range, does that seem appropriate?
I would only put a high range, a high thing. Let's not do anything on a low. Because if somebody could figure out how to do it with, you know, 8 dwelling units per acre or 1 dwelling unit per acre, and they want to incorporate it and they think that they can
make
it work.
How do you define that? There may be a 6-acre site.
I don't know that I want to put a low end on it, but...
Well, the reason for having the low end is so that you get true multiple residence type of activity as opposed to townhouses or single family.
Let me throw something out to you, because I was in, I can't remember what community it was in California, San Luis Obispo, I think it was. And they took it was great because they took an infill commercial center, tore down the ugly strip center, and came in and they put a new commercial site, and then right behind it they put a two-story residential, which was really cool, but I'll guarantee it didn't come up to 15 units an acre. Mm-hmm. Because you still had, it was a mixed use, but the total number of units didn't meet that, and yet the density on that parcel was about at 15. But when you how you calculated the density per acre, there's no way it got up to 15.
Sure.
And I think that those are the kinds of developments you'd like to encourage. So, and yet it doesn't meet the 15, but you're really building 15 units on a much smaller footprint.
Got it.
You follow what I'm saying?
Sure.
So how we define that, I agree with Dave, is that we should encourage development, but not put a low end, because I think we're putting a whole type of development, pushing it off the table inadvertently.
Yeah, if the market could shake out something that's a little bit different and it pencils out and it's high quality and it's mm-hmm. it meets our design standards, I want to encourage that too. So even if it ends up being 10.
Well, and if it comes back to council in some form, you still have the ability sure. to review it then, so we don't end up with single.
Oh, yeah, because remember, you get density two ways. You get density by either building a lot of units spread out or even more dense on a smaller piece. And you know, you can go up or you can go out. And I think when you throw a standard number in, you sort of pigeonhole us.
Okay. Yeah, do we even want to have a density range?
I mean, like the maximum.
If we have the ability to have oversight over what that might look like, you know, why would we cap the density on the high end even?
I think there's some natural caps, and it's just for certainty. I mean,
well, and part of this is the question. I mean, they always have the ability to request the council use permit to have the density range go exceed the 25.
Yeah.
Or exceed the 15, depending.
25 is pretty intense use.
That's an R4. That's the current R4. It would be the.
And I seriously doubt. I don't know of anyone that actually build to the 25, because they're, you know, you go above 25, now you're going above four stories in most cases, and that's a whole different construction.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's some natural limitations that are on there. So
there might be some places that we would accept that, though. So mm-hmm. I guess sure. anything
they can go with the council use permit.
Just a mechanism that if you're over 25 dwelling units, then there's a mechanism to do that if mm-hmm. it's council use permit or something like that.
Sure.
Okay.
And
yeah,
Mayor,
that'll work.
Could I just repeat what I thought I heard to make sure we have the right direction?
You may have to read the actual transcript to repeat it. Go ahead.
I think what I heard was that the council's looking for uses by right, but the ability to have control over site plan. And so we'll come up with a process and some recommendations on that.
Boy,
what about
the succinct and I think to the point.
What about design guidelines on a transition like this?
We would probably use the multiple residence guidelines that we're building into the code, which have both urban and auto or suburban and urban standards that go along with
them. Would design review board look at this at all?
Anything over 15 units an acre is required to go to DR.
Okay.
Oh, wouldn't the commercial pull it into it also?
Yes.
Okay.
So mixed use are going to go to the design review board either way.
Okay. And then the other...
The new and improved design review board.
And then the other standard that we were talking about was reservation of a minimum of 40% to keep that commercial element as part of the project in a commercial district. Is that a good threshold?
I think it's an industry standard, sort of, and it if you go beyond that, it seems like you've changed the whole nature of the site, and it should go through a rezone.
Okay.
Now, if we get down the road, we find that it creates the same type of monotony, and it creates huge barriers to reusing. I want to keep it open to revisit that.
Okay. Yeah, just any variation from the 40%, just have it come.
I agree with
the standards.
And I know we're having sort of a two-way conversation, and the rest of you are certainly invited at some point to join in.
The paper.
Okay,
I think what we're looking at is that we want to create create some real flexibility, and we want to make it as easy as possible for people to take what are existing C2, which we recognize we have way far excess supply, and to create a use that recognizes the current day situation and make it as easy as possible.
They didn't make it onto because they kind of came a little bit later. The one is the email that I passed out this morning relative to the Maynard Dairy, which is in Southeast Mesa. They would like to start a Schnepp Farms type of, the term is agritainment they use. We don't have a current mechanism for allowing that right now. We would propose to do a special use permit in the agricultural district to authorize that. We think that's probably the right approach. The second is, and it's probably something I need to bring back later, is that is whether or not to consider off-track bedding as part of the zoning code update, or to bring that back after the zoning code update gets adopted. Should we incorporate that as part of the update process, or we're finishing up our research now? We've been busy with other things.
When did we talk about that? That was a year ago?
Yeah, it was back in June.
Oh,
so.
Okay. Seems like a year ago.
Yeah. It's been a while, but we haven't had a chance to research it. We're getting the final research done now. We can come back with recommendations, but do you want to incorporate it as part of the overall code update, or do we wait and come back later and talk about it, as bring it back as a separate issue?
What is easiest for you?
I can, if sometime between now and February, if we have time on the study session agendas to bring it back.
Whatever's the most expeditious. I think we had a pretty extensive discussion the last time we talked about it, conceptually.
Yeah, no, it, we.
So I don't know whether I want to revisit that.
Gordon is getting a fair amount of pressure to come up with an answer, and we've sort of been putting the issue off for 6 months. So I think that's the reason for asking to try to get that answer.
Feeling? Is there any strong feeling one way or another? Yeah. I don't know that anyone feels that strongly one way or another. So whatever's most expeditious and can do it the most efficiently.
If we can try to incorporate it into the update, I think that would be the easiest.
Yeah. Okay, if that's the easiest, the most expeditious, let's do it.
Okay, then we'll.
So then you're going to have the conversation with us.
Yeah, well, we're finishing up the research now. I don't quite have from the police department, but they're requesting it from other cities in terms of the criminal statistics and the analysis of that. Once I have that, then we can schedule another study session sometime before adoption.
That's fine.
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you.
Any other questions? See, that was easy, right?
Yes.
Okay, good. All righty. Here reports on meetings and conferences attended. Nothing. Everyone wants to go home. Mr. Brady.
Just a reminder, there's the MLK dinner banquet Saturday evening. Reception at 6, dinner at 7. And the next, we have no council meeting Monday because of the holiday. So Thursday, January 20th, see you at the study session.
Okay.
All right.
And there was an event that we attended last night that I can't help but
sure
refer, and that was a very wonderful reception and a celebration of service for our Vice Mayor. Kyle, thank you so very much.
Thank you.
And this is the last full-blown study session because I'm out of town next week, so you're in charge. So thank you.
I can guarantee you it'll go a lot faster.
All the nice things I said about you, too. All right, do we have a motion to adjourn?
Depending on the topic.
Oh, okay. A motion adjourned from Councilmember Kavanaugh, a second from Vice Mayor. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
We are adjourned. Thank you very much.